expedients. Improved production methods meant that more commodities reached the market. But capitalists still needed to keep wages down so as to derive surplus value from each worker. Yet this meant that labor would not have the purchasing power to buy the additional goods. And in this case, production could no longer be profitable. The system would therefore face a crisis of overproduction leading to two results. First, there would be a period of takeovers and mergers as the strongest enterprises forced competitors out of business and effectively destroyed some of the means of production. Second, there would be a depression of wages and the creation of mass unemployment, with increasing poverty and suffering for the proletariat. Eventually, this would lead to a new phase of production in which further capital accumulation, based on profits derived from surplus value, would again be possible. But the same structural problems would remain, and new crises were endemic in the system. Moreover, each crisis would tend to be more severe than the previous one, eventually leading to the breakdown of the system itself. Marx appeared to be saying something very categorical, that the position of the proletariat was becoming ever more wretched, and that the downfall of capitalism was inevitable. In fact, he may have been less certain about the absolute decline in working-class living standards than it often appeared. He also believed that trade unionism and reforms could lead to definite improvements in the situation of the workers, and that subsistence was an historical concept, the content of which would be affected by evolving conceptions of the minimum acceptable standard of living with economic and technological development. Similarly, despite rhetoric that sometimes implied that the collapse of capitalism was imminent, elsewhere he suggested that it would take a very long time to exhaust all its possibilities of expansion. Yet the notion of eventual breakdown was embedded in both Marx's materialist conception of history and in his political economy of capitalism. The seeds of transformation were inherent within the operation of the existing system, which was never static. The future was not to be created by establishing communities practicing a new system, as the utopian socialists had believed, or by a group of people smashing the state, as in some anarchist visions. However, Marx certainly did not believe that everything was determined by structural forces. On the contrary, political activity by the proletariat was essential. Its growing class consciousness also meant developing awareness of the bourgeoisie as both separate and antagonistic. From this, social and revolutionary consciousness would also emerge over time. Thus, the structural features of capitalism created an objective antagonism between the two fundamental classes within it. But the development and operation of the system then produced the kind of subjective consciousness that would ultimately lead to a revolutionary process, focusing on the capture of state power. This followed from Marx and Engels' theory of the origins of the state. This, it was argued, had really developed only with the earliest division of labor, which had itself arisen once society had been able to produce a surplus off which some people could live, without contributing directly to producing the means of life for the whole community. Thereafter, the state had primarily been an instrument to serve the interests of the dominant class in each social system. The most famous expression of this viewpoint was in the claim in the Communist Manifesto that the executive of the modern state is but a committee for managing the common affairs of the whole bourgeoisie. This no doubt overstated Marx and Engels' position, but expressed the essence of their theory. The state, the dominant ideology, the legal system, and a host of other institutions combined to serve the interests of the bourgeoisie and to uphold the capitalist system. Thus, the critique of the existing system included its political institutions, for these served the interests that oppressed the overwhelming majority of the population. The emphasis of Marx's writing and speeches suggested that revolutionary change would involve violence. Yet he was also critical of those who equated revolution with insurrection or a coup by an organized group. Marx's point was that the revolutionary crisis was the culmination of a much longer evolutionary process within the existing society. This meant that a premature attempt to bring about revolutionary change could not succeed. And he criticized the violence of the most radical elements, the Jacobins, in the French Revolution, arguing that this had followed from the attempt to impose conditions for which society was not yet ready. In 1848, and at the time of the Paris Commune in 1871, he appeared to accept the need for violence. But at other times he urged the path of reform. He even held out the possibility of peaceful revolution, suggesting that Britain, the USA, and Holland might possess the appropriate conditions for this to take place. After Marx's death, Engels seemed more decided on this path, working with the German Sozialdemokratische Partei Deutschlands, SPD, on practical programs for reform. The other general element in Marx and Engels' conception of revolutionary change concerned the role of the working class and of a political party. They seem to have taken it for granted that the development of class consciousness led, almost automatically, as they put it in the Communist Manifesto, to the organization of the proletarians into a class and consequently into a political party. In other words, the implication was that the proletariat was only a class in a full sense when it was conscious of itself as such, and at this point, it also turned itself into a political party. The working class was thus the agent in the revolutionary process, and a political party would be its instrument in this struggle. But Marx and Engels were not at all categorical as to when or how this kind of transformation would come about. Marx and Engels revolutionized thinking about society, transcending conventional boundaries between fact and value, and between philosophy, history, economics, sociology, and politics. As an explanation of historical change, an analysis of the dynamics of capitalism, and a prognosis about the role of the working class as an agency for transcending that system, Marx and Engels' work expressed theoretical insights that far surpassed those of their predecessors. It is also worth noting that when, in his Critique of the Gotha Programma, 1875, Marx discussed the features of a post-revolutionary society, he was rather cautious about the extent of progress, particularly in relation to equality, that could be made in the first phase of communist society. It was only in the higher phase that society could inscribe on its banners, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. His explanation of the transition from the first to the second stage may not be entirely convincing, but despite the rhetorical flourishes in some of their work, Marx and Engels were providing a general approach to analysis rather than a set of right answers. Yet to acknowledge the crucial importance of their insights is not to suggest that they were entirely valid in their own time, let alone in the 21st century. The elements of the theory will be discussed later in the book. Social Democracy Before 1914. By 1883, when Marx died, the major features of socialist ideas had been established. Utopian socialists, anarchists, and Marxists had many crucial points of disagreement, but there was a common emphasis on equality, cooperation, and social solidarity. All also stressed their commitment to the poorer social strata, although it was only with Marx that a specific theory of class and class conflict had crystallized. However, it was after his death that the final forms of modern socialism emerged, with the dominance of political parties. Between the 1880s and the outbreak of the First World War, there was a massive growth in socialist parties in Europe, all of which came together in the Second International, founded in 1889. However, these parties were ambiguous in various ways. In the first place, their names, confusing at the time, have become much more so in the light of later developments. For although they were collectively known as socialist parties when meeting in the International, and most of them professed the goal of socialism, only a minority used the term in their own names. Some used workers or labor, but the most common title was Social Democratic Party. Communist parties did not yet exist, and social democracy covered a spectrum of views, including those that would later identify themselves with communism. With the formation of communist parties after the First World War, social democrats and communists would become bitter antagonists, and in the process, social democracy would change. With the British Labour Party as the only important exception, all these parties owed their doctrinal inspiration to the Marxist critique of capitalism. The SPD was easily the largest party in the International and was the most dominant intellectually. During these years, Karl Kautsky, 1854 to 1938, became the most influential interpreter of Marxist doctrine, not only in the German Social Democratic Party, but in the International as a whole. Having lived in London for much of the 1880s, he became quite close to Engels, and this reinforced his credentials as the authentic voice of Marxism. However, he tended to interpret it in a rather mechanical way, emphasizing the inevitability of the eventual triumph of socialism. His position also epitomized the difficulties of attempting to reconcile a revolutionary doctrine with electoral and parliamentary politics, and incorporated the key tensions between reform and revolution that characterized the International as a whole. The SPD's program was agreed at Erfurt in 1891, and as Donald Sassoon has argued, two aspects coexisted within it with rather tenuous links between them. The first part was an orthodox Marxist summary of the situation, stressing the division of society into two hostile camps. With fewer large-scale capitalist enterprises constantly expanding their control over the economic system, ever more serious crises of overproduction, and the necessity for the SPD to acquire political power so as to establish a socialist system based on common ownership. The second part concentrated on a series of measures that appeared to constitute a program of reform within the system, rather than its total transformation. There were always different shades of opinion within the party, but the general agreement was that this was a program that combined immediate benefits for the proletariat with the long-term goal of socialism. In other words, it was generally seen as both a reformist and revolutionary program, with reform sought within capitalism, not as a substitute for revolution, but as a means towards it. This was the dominant interpretation within the SPD and more widely within the Second International. By 1914, the emergence of parties with a form of Marxist theory as the dominant ideology seeking mass membership and majority electoral support had already pushed alternative socialist traditions to the margins. This did not mean that there were no challengers. For example, in the years immediately before the war, there was a sharp increase in militant rank-and-file strikes in several European countries. This reflected a belief, often defined as syndicalism, that direct, industrial action, rather than working through political parties, was the way to achieve change and construct a new society. Yet it was already evident that these were alternative rather than mainstream positions. One further element in the newly dominant tradition of socialism was its professed acceptance of working-class internationalism. It was generally understood that all the parties shared the view that workers had no country because their common enemy was capitalism. Hence, all of them agreed, in theory, that they would be totally opposed to a capitalist war. None of them, it was constantly asserted, would support their own governments should such a war break out. In reality, most of them did just this in 1914. This certainly increased the divisions within the parties, with an active minority opposing both the mainstream leadership and the war, yet. It may have been possible to reconstruct the international after the war, had it not been for the Bolshevik Communist Revolution in 1917. The emergence of communism. Modern communism was created with the assumption of power in Russia by the Bolshevik Party. Subsequently, the new rulers claimed that the party represented the authentic application of Marxism in the contemporary era, and implied that there was continuity between themselves and the 19th century communists. In fact, the relationship between Bolshevism and Marxism remains highly controversial, and the idea of continuity is very dubious. There was no clear distinction between communism and socialism for most of the previous century. At times, the term communism had implied a more revolutionary approach to bringing about change, and this impression was perhaps reinforced when Marx and Engels published the Communist Manifesto in 1848. But the manifesto was written for the so-called Communist League, a group of emigre German workers that soon faded away, and the terms socialist and communist were not even used consistently by Marx and Engels. In any case, according to all the guardians of orthodoxy, Russia should not have been the location for the first Marxist-inspired revolution, for the peasantry formed the overwhelming majority of the population, and serfdom had only been abolished as recently as 1861. The idea that the revolution would first occur in an advanced capitalist country had been emphasized by Marx and Engels and embedded in the thinking of the socialists of the Second International. Until 1914, Russian Marxists had generally shared this view and had tended to defer to Kautsky, the main theorist of the German SPD, on many issues of doctrine. However, developments that had already taken place in the Russian party, along with a crisis over the war, now combined to transform the situation. The Russian Social Democratic Labor Party had been formed in 1899 as the main organizational focus for Russian Marxists. However, it had soon dissolved into factions, one of which had been led by Vladimir Lenin, 1870 to 1924, because of his energy, clarity, and revolutionary commitment, he soon emerged as a leading figure, and in What Is to Be Done, 1902, he proposed that a wholly new type of party should be established. This proved highly divisive at the Party Congress in 1903 and brought about a split, with the Bolsheviks now effectively operating as a separate party even before the final break in 1912. Lenin, and the Bolsheviks more generally, were totally opposed to socialists in any part of the world who supported the war. He denounced them in the most bitter terms and sought, unsuccessfully, to persuade dissident socialists to turn the international war into a revolutionary war in their own countries. The Bolshevik seizure of power transformed the power relationships within the International Socialist Movement. The Bolsheviks changed their name to the Communist Party soon after the revolution. The term Bolshevik had simply meant majority. And Moscow became the center of the doctrine that now became known as communism. It is therefore necessary to consider some of its main features in Russia around the time of the revolution. Lenin returned to Russia from exile in April 1917, a month after the first revolution that had overthrown the Tsar and brought a provisional government to power, with Alexander Kerensky, 1881 to 1970, at its head. Soviets, workers' councils, had also been established in the major cities, demanding food and peace, but under pressure from Britain and France, Kerensky was insisting on continuing with the war. Although it was obvious that the majority of the population was desperate to end the fighting, most of the Bolsheviks still believed that it was impossible for a socialist revolution to take place in a backward country. It took Lenin's personal ascendancy to convince them that a successful revolution was indeed possible in Russia, and that this would then be followed by revolutions elsewhere. In these circumstances, the hope was that like-minded governments in more advanced countries would then help the development of socialism in Russia. With the slogans of "All power to the Soviets" and "Bread, land, and peace," the Bolsheviks secured a majority in the Soviets and achieved a revolutionary insurrection that enabled them to take control in a situation where there was, in effect, a power vacuum. Shortly before the seizure of power, Lenin had written The State and Revolution, which had been wildly optimistic about the way in which socialism could be established after a revolution. The reality was quite different, for the Bolsheviks were now faced with four tasks that were not easily reconcilable. First, they had to establish themselves in power, when they had only a minority of support in the country. Second, they needed to implement measures that would demonstrably change social relationships in a rigidly authoritarian society based on traditional hierarchies. Third, they needed to maintain the temporary alliance between the peasantry and the urban proletariat that had enabled them to seize control. Fourth, they needed to bring about massive economic growth so as to improve living standards. It is perhaps hardly surprising that they failed, particularly as their more positive aims were necessarily subordinated, until the end of 1920, to the urgent task of winning a civil war. However, the situation led to a particular form of authoritarian socialism becoming increasingly marked. Even after the Bolsheviks had taken over, they talked of a democratically elected constituent assembly as the body that would rule, and they clearly expected to win a majority there. However, when the election results in January 1918 showed that they had won only 21% of the seats, they dissolved the assembly. As far as Lenin was concerned, the situation by then was such that the only alternatives were Bolshevik rule or rule by the extreme right, and he was not willing to risk the latter. It is quite probable that his analysis of the situation was valid, but the decision obviously had important political implications. It soon led to a situation in which the communists were dominating all organs of power, and by the end of the Civil War, the party and the Red Army had become increasingly autocratic. Each new extension of power was justified as a temporary measure. But the party-state dictatorship was now being constructed. At the beginning, severe repression in some spheres, for example against religion, was coupled with a real attempt to open up culture, spread educational opportunities, and bring about sexual equality. But as early as December 1917, the Cheka, or secret police, was established to discover and suppress any attempts at counter-revolution. It used summary executions and imprisonment against any suspects, some of whom were regarded as such simply because of their social origins. After an attempt on Lenin's life in May 1918, the Red Terror was promulgated, leading to thousands of executions and the Cheka operating almost as a state within the state. By 1920, the economy was also destitute after 6 years of war. The support of the peasantry was in danger of being lost completely, and some 8 million people had died from disease and malnutrition since the Bolshevik Revolution. The break between communism and social democracy. While many European socialists were exhilarated by the first Marxist-inspired revolution, others were less convinced. As they watched the dissolution of the Constituent Assembly, the Revolutionary Terror, and the evolution towards a one-party state, their doubts as to whether this was really socialism increased. In some cases, particularly among the leaders of West European socialist parties, such sentiments were probably reinforced when they heard themselves denounced as traitors and renegades by the Soviet leaders. Other Western socialists were prepared to accept that such harsh measures might be necessary in Russian conditions, where there had been no tradition of democracy, and where counter-revolutionaries also used terror as a political weapon. But they did not believe that they could be justified in countries where peaceful change through constitutional means might be possible. Others went further than this and questioned whether the Bolshevik Revolution could even be justified in Marxist terms. One of the most powerful arguments of this kind was put forward in December 1920 at a Congress of the French Socialist Party. The Congress was held at Tours to decide whether or not the party should affiliate to the new Communist International. Léon Blum, 1872-1950, who would become prime minister in the French Popular Front government in 1936, was the leader of one of the groups that were totally opposed to affiliation. In his speech, he claimed that the dictatorship in Russia stemmed from its conception of revolution. Instead of a seizure of power following a long period of evolution creating the preconditions for socialism, it had been interpreted in terms of insurrection by a small group, who then needed to create those preconditions. Whereas the Marxist conception was of a temporary impersonal dictatorship based on mass support, the Bolshevik one was of semi-permanent dictatorship exercised by a centralized and hierarchical party. Blum was thus implying either that socialism could not be established in this way, or that the only form of socialism that would emerge was one that negated its own ideals because it was inherently undemocratic. However, he was defeated at the Congress, where there was considerable enthusiasm for the Russian Revolution, and the majority now formed the French Communist Party. The fissure that opened up between communism and social democracy developed in the aftermath of the Bolshevik Revolution, but it is also necessary to appreciate some aspects of Lenin's thinking that had been revealed even before 1914 and which were institutionalized after the revolution. The most fundamental element in all this was his absolute and total commitment to the goal of socialist revolution. This underlay his whole strategic and tactical approach, including important innovations. For example, Marxists had normally tended to regard the urban working class as the vehicle for socialist revolution and had been rather indifferent to the peasantry and to the forces of nationalism. However, Lenin had understood that a revolution could take place in Russia only on the basis of alliances with the peasantry, the overwhelming mass of the population, and the numerous subject nationalities that sought liberation from rule by the Russian majority. but it was Lenin's belief in the necessity for a particular kind of party to hasten the revolutionary process that was of particular relevance for the subsequent split with social democracy. Lenin put forward his idea of a vanguard party, based on revolutionaries fighting a class war in the same way that the military fought a conventional war. This differed from anything suggested by Marx and Engels, for, although they had taken it for granted that a party would be necessary, they had also insisted that the working class would emancipate itself. However, Lenin now argued that, left to itself, the working class would develop trade union consciousness, but not revolutionary consciousness. In other words, conflicts over pay and working conditions would inevitably arise, but the workers would not themselves locate these issues within a wider Marxist framework, because workers would remain integrated within the dominant ideological framework. It was necessary for revolutionary socialist consciousness to be brought to them by a vanguard party that did understand Marxist theory, whose members would tend to be bourgeois intellectuals. This was obviously an extremely contentious notion. Lenin might argue that this was not party control over the workers, because it would be working with them, but there were certainly elements of elitism. The workers had a false consciousness that must be redirected by those with superior understanding. The serious implications of this notion were reinforced by Lenin's ideas about party organization, for all the emphasis was upon secrecy, centralization, and professional revolutionaries. Some of his thinking was certainly shaped by the need to operate in clandestine conditions during the Tsarist autocracy, which he contrasted with the relatively open conditions in Germany. Yet he slid from a discussion about the Russian situation to far more general notions, which implied that centralism and secrecy were more important to him than democracy. Furthermore, the very idea of a party leadership having the right to impose a single view on its members was highly questionable. The result was surely bound to be one in which policy directives became diktats, with most members simply having to take it on trust that decisions had been arrived at through discussion and debate. This was compounded by the fact that the party discourse under Lenin was always based on binary alternatives. A given idea or policy was either bourgeois or socialist. Shades of gray did not exist. Although many commentators have tended to regard the Leninist party as pivotal for the subsequent establishment of the dictatorship by Stalin, 1879 to 1953, it can equally well be argued that he destroyed and bypassed it. Many revolutionary Marxists, who are highly critical of the direction taken by the Soviet Union, therefore continue to believe that the Leninist conception of the party, based on the system of democratic centralism, was valid, and the problems only developed with later applications of that conception. Yet it is notable that two of the most eminent Marxist revolutionaries of the era had themselves criticized Lenin's notion of the vanguard party when it had first been formulated. Rosa Luxemburg, 1871 to 1919, was a revolutionary Marxist in the German SPD. She was often deeply critical of the leadership of her own party, because she believed it was becoming too dominated by short-term reforms and was losing sight of the ultimate goal of socialist revolution. However, she believed in mass action by the working class as the way of bringing about change, and was critical of Lenin's concept of a vanguard party. In 1903, she attacked it for ultra-centralism, which she equated with the sterile spirit of the overseer. Lenin's concern is not so much to make the activity of the party more fruitful as to control the party, to narrow the movement rather than to develop it, to bind rather than unify it. Once the Russian Revolution took place, she gave it cautious support and was a leading figure in the German Communist Party when it was established in December 1918. However, the next month, she and Karl Liebknecht, another prominent figure in the new party, were arrested by German cavalry officers who were suppressing a revolutionary uprising. Both were murdered while in custody. So Luxemburg did not live to witness the subsequent development of the Soviet system and the uses that would be made of the Leninist Party. The other early critic was Leon Trotsky, 1879 to 1940. When Lenin developed his concept of the party, Trotsky had not supported him, but subsequently he changed his mind and became a leading figure in the revolution of 1917 and the post-revolutionary regime. When Lenin died in January 1924, Trotsky was one of the two most probable successors, but he was outmaneuvered by Stalin, who expelled him from the Soviet Union in 1929. In exile, he denounced the betrayal of revolution and sought to revive the original spirit of Bolshevism as he interpreted it. As a result, he was assassinated by Stalin's agents in Mexico in 1940. Trotsky always insisted that there was no basis for Stalinism in Lenin's concept of the party, and this view has generally been taken by the Trotskyist parties that subsequently developed in many parts of the world. However, his initial verdict on the idea could be taken as a prediction of the methods that Stalin would later use and from which Trotsky himself would suffer. In 1904, he thus wrote, "In inner party politics, these methods of Lenin lead, as we shall yet see, to this. The party organization substitutes itself for the party, the central committee substitutes itself for the organization, and finally, a dictator substitutes himself for the central committee." The origins of Bolshevik party organization lay in Russian conditions, but by 1919 the situation had been transformed. Convinced that a revolution could occur elsewhere, and particularly in Germany, if the organizational and ideological features of Bolshevism were adopted, the model was now imposed on all parties seeking to join the new Communist International, the Comintern, created in Moscow. The entry conditions required all who joined to accept the doctrine and practices of the Bolsheviks in their own parties, and in effect, the Comintern itself also sought to replicate this organizational principle, with the policies of the individual parties largely determined by the executive committee. This notion of a centrally controlled vanguard revolutionary party was distasteful to socialists with a belief in reform and democracy. Thus, when the Comintern insisted that this model must be imposed on all member parties, with the policies of each communist party determined by the executive committee, the break with social democracy was clear. Yet it would be wrong to attribute responsibility for the break entirely to Lenin and the Bolsheviks, for the Marxist terminology of Second International Socialism had also masked a tendency that now became much stronger, the pursuit of socialism through constitutional means. Before the war, only the British Labour Party had explicitly avowed constitutional politics as the sole means to bring about change, and it had also concentrated on practical reforms rather than discussions of ultimate goals. Elsewhere, it had generally been maintained that the achievement of reforms was just one element in a Marxist revolutionary strategy. While there was room for considerable skepticism as to whether this was, in fact, what the parties were practicing, the official claim had just about survived intact until 1914. Thereafter, their support for the war had exposed a gap between rhetoric and reality. Moreover, the performance of some of the parties after the fighting ended confirmed the view that working within the system would supersede any previous claims that the objective was to overthrow it through extra-parliamentary activity. The most notorious instance of this was the SPD's collaboration with the old elites to establish the Weimar Republic in 1919, rather than to support those who were attempting to overthrow capitalism through revolution. It is highly unlikely that a revolution could have succeeded, but the caution of the SPD leadership was widely criticized both at the time and subsequently. Its reliance on paramilitary forces was to make the break between social democracy and communism particularly bitter in Germany. However, the more general point is that after 1920, a new form of social democracy emerged that had effectively abandoned the idea of seeking socialism through a revolutionary seizure of power. Many of the parties still used Marxist discourse and attempted to justify their policies in relation to the ultimate goal of revolution. Some breakaway parties even fought bravely to find a third way between communism and social democracy in the so-called Vienna, or Second and a Half, International, before abandoning the attempt in 1923. However, this was much less significant than the fact that the parties that then formed the Labour and Socialist International concentrated primarily on seeking power through parliamentary means and advocating practical reforms, with the British Labour Party entering the mainstream of social democracy. This does not mean that they no longer aspired to establish socialism by abolishing capitalism, but there was now an absolute division between social democracy and communism. Communists were institutionally part of the Comintern and sought to emulate Soviet theory and practice. Social democrats rejected the Soviet model and effectively accepted the notion that there was some convergence between their own views and those of others, such as left-wing liberals, who believed in parliamentary democracy and social reform. Two kinds of political parties, allegedly serving the interests of the social classes, had become the main agencies for the establishment of socialism, and these two traditions now struggled for ascendancy in Europe and the rest of the world. Chapter 2. Cuban Communism and Swedish Social Democracy. Developments in Communism and Social Democracy. The fissure between communism and social democracy that developed in the aftermath of the Bolshevik Revolution never really healed. Certainly there were times, particularly between 1935 and 1939, and between 1941 and 1945, when it seemed that common opposition to fascism might transcend the divisions of the left. There were also some countries, for example, Italy during the early post-war period, where there was considerable support for unity. However, in general, communists and social democrats remained in separate and hostile camps, particularly at the height of the Cold War. Yet neither tradition was monolithic or unchanging. In general, social democratic parties experienced persistent difficulties in self-definition after the break with communism. As most of them had claimed to be Marxist before 1914, and had disputed the communist appropriation of the doctrine in the early post-war period, it was difficult simply to abandon it thereafter. On the other hand, it was clear that they accepted liberal democratic institutions as the primary route through which to implement changes. Some parties, particularly those competing for the allegiance of the working class with a large communist party, continued to claim Marxism as a doctrinal source long after it ceased to play an important role in influencing policy. The French Socialist Party was particularly prone to this. Thus, Léon Blum, still facing the pre-1914 problem as to whether a socialist party could participate in a bourgeois coalition, distinguished between the exercise of power, participation in government, and the conquest of power, overthrow of capitalism. Yet although his Popular Front government in 1936 implemented some important reforms immediately after coming to power, Its subsequent economic policy was very orthodox and unimaginative. In Germany, the situation of the SPD was to become more catastrophic. Despite its preeminent role in establishing the liberal democratic system in 1919 and remaining committed to it during the years of acute instability until 1923, the party was then normally excluded from power, although it secured the largest share of the vote until 1930. In 1928, the SPD's success in the elections made it impossible to form a cabinet without it, but it would not agree to the cut in unemployment benefits sought by its partners. The result was the effective abolition of the parliamentary system and rule by decree from 1930. The bitter division between the SPD and the Communist Party then prevented a united front against Nazism, though both parties were immediate victims after Hitler's takeover of power in 1933. The SPD had wanted to uphold the democratic system and remained committed to constitutionalism even when it was increasingly evident that its opponents supported dictatorship. But it never formulated a program of reform to resolve the economic crisis after 1929, tending to share the communist belief that this was the final collapse of capitalism. The SPD represented interwar social democracy in its most tragic form. However, the difficulties were not confined to the parties that still claimed a Marxist influence. Neither of the brief attempts of the British Labour Party to wield power through minority governments in the interwar period was notably successful. In particular, its failure to deal with the economic depression in 1931 and the decision of its leader and then Prime Minister, Ramsay MacDonald, 1866 to 1937, to head a conservative-dominated coalition in order to implement austerity measures, led to the worst crisis the party ever faced. Confined to opposition for the rest of the interwar period, it was divided and relatively impotent until it joined the wartime coalition led by Winston Churchill. The raison d'être of social democracy after the split with communism had been the claim that socialism could be implemented peacefully. However, with the notable exception of Sweden, the general experience of the interwar period was one of clear failure. Most capitalist societies experienced either serious economic depression, characterized by mass unemployment, and a reduction in social expenditure, or still worse, the elimination of liberal democracy and its replacement by extreme right-wing dictatorship. Such outcomes clearly constituted a practical and intellectual defeat for the project of social democracy, for it had certainly not demonstrated its ability to eliminate poverty and create a more equal society imbued with the values of cooperation and solidarity. Subsequently, both the nature of social democracy and the problems it faced underwent further changes. During the interwar period, the only major liberal democratic country that had successfully implemented practical measures to revive the economy and create jobs had been the USA, under President Roosevelt and the New Deal. However, Roosevelt was not a socialist, but a pragmatic American Democrat. Similarly, the foremost economist who had explained in theoretical terms how a government could stimulate economic expansion during a depression had been John Maynard Keynes, 1883 to 1946, a British liberal. So neither the practical nor the theoretical originators of the reforms underlying post-war capitalism were from the social democratic tradition. But when Keynesian economics was put into practice between the late 1940s and the early 1970s, there was a prolonged period of economic growth, leading to far higher living standards in Western Europe, and a much greater proportion of GNP devoted to welfare expenditure than ever before. But this raised new questions for social democracy. Had capitalism been changed by social democracy so that its values were now incorporated in the system? Or had capitalism in advanced industrial countries become so successful that it could now afford concessions to the working classes, whether or not these were demanded by social democracy? Naturally, the parties sought to convince their electorates that they had brought about the changes, but paradoxically, it could also be argued that one of the main factors underpinning the development of welfare capitalism in the post-war era was the role of the USA in the Cold War. In any case, the more relevant point was the impact of these changes on the nature of social democracy. As social expenditure increased and full employment was established, most social democratic parties underwent a further evolution. Most now became more openly committed to the goal of progressive social reform, rather than the total elimination of the capitalist system. This was not a smooth or uniform process, for the parties contained minorities that adhered to a more traditional version of socialism. Some parties even insisted that they had not changed. Certainly, important differences remained between them, with variations in ideology, relationships with trade unions, and the social composition of the members and supporters of the parties. Yet social democracy could now be characterized as a tradition seeking to promote increasing benefits for the working classes within a primarily capitalist system. The fact that control over much of the economy remained in private hands inevitably limited the power of social democracy, and further constraints stemmed from its need to secure electoral support for its measures. Communism also evolved after the break with social democracy. After 1917, communist parties were established throughout the world, but until the end of the Second World War, communism was inseparable from the Soviet experience. For it was only there that a communist regime was in power, and the other parties demonstrated their allegiance to it. However, after the Second World War, the communist movement gradually became less monolithic and Soviet control was reduced. The leader of Yugoslavia, Josip Broz Tito, 1892-1980, had a serious dispute with Stalin and had broken away from the Soviet bloc by 1948. The system he established was based on one-party rule, but with far greater decentralization of the economy than in the Soviet Union. Of greater importance, in 1949 the Chinese Communist Party under Mao Zedong, 1893-1976, finally achieved power after more than 20 years of revolutionary struggle and civil war. The Chinese system differed very considerably from the Soviet model, with much more emphasis on the continuing role of the peasantry. Furthermore, by the 1960s, relations between China and the Soviet Union had become so poor that border clashes took place and a war seemed possible. This also led to divisions within the international communist movement, and some now turned to Maoism for their inspiration, as the revolutionaries in Nepal still do. Other communist regimes had been established in North Korea, following a division in the country after the Second World War. In Vietnam, initially in the north of the country but throughout the whole state in 1975 following the withdrawal of the U.S. after a prolonged war, and in Cuba, following the revolution in 1959. Greater diversity in communism also followed from revelations made by the Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev, 1894-1971, at the Soviet Party Congress in 1956. There he denounced aspects of Stalin's rule and presented some of the evidence about the atrocities that had taken place. This led some West European communist parties, particularly those in Italy and Spain, gradually to move away from Soviet control and, during the 1970s, to proclaim the doctrine of Euro-communism. In this, they declare their acceptance of a multi-party system, free speech, and many characteristics of liberal democracy. But despite their many differences, all communist states maintained a single-party system, substantial state ownership of the economy, and adherence to an official ideology based on an interpretation of Marxism, and the maintenance of power through non-democratic means. Commentary on both communism and social democracy has tended to be dominated by a concentration upon the biggest powers, the Soviet Union and China in relation to communism, and Germany, Britain, and France in relation to social democracy. While this is certainly justifiable in the sense that world history is dominated by the big battalions, it can also lead to unjustifiably negative conclusions about socialism. This is particularly obvious in respect of the Soviet Union and China, where the very scale of violence and repression makes it difficult to scrutinize the costs and benefits of the regimes in a dispassionate way. The failings of social democratic governments in the large European states bear no comparison with the crimes of Stalinism or Maoism, but it is difficult to argue that they ever created an alternative model of society reflecting socialist values. While no party has been entirely successful in this respect, Swedish social democracy and Cuban communism both attempted to implement the goals of equality, cooperation, and solidarity, and both demonstrated significant achievements. It is for this reason that these two states have been selected as case studies. However, in presenting these case studies side by side, I am not suggesting symmetry between them. The important differences between communism and social democracy that emerged after the Bolshevik Revolution affected the ideological universe of each, particularly in relation to such key issues as democracy and private ownership. The environments in which they have operated have also been quite different. In 1959, the year of the Cuban Revolution, Swedish social democrats had the comparative luxury of living in a wealthy and stable liberal democracy, facing no significant external threat. While the dominating preoccupations for Fidel Castro were the poverty of the island and its extreme vulnerability to attack by a bitterly hostile superpower just across the water. Nevertheless, there were also some interesting points of comparison. For both Swedish social democrats and Cuban communists have tried to bring about significant social changes in a world dominated by much larger powers, and both have been increasingly constrained by changes in the wider international political economy. Swedish social democracy. Origins and characteristics of the Swedish model. The Swedish Social Democratic Party, Socialdemokratiska Arbetarpartiet, or SAP, paid formal obeisance to Marxism before 1914, but there were some strongly revisionist overtones in both its rhetoric and formal statements even then. Moreover, Hjalmar Branting, who dominated the party from 1900 until 1925, had originally been a liberal, and particularly in his later years, sought to effect a synthesis between liberalism and socialism. Another important figure, Per Albin Hansson, who became the first SAP prime minister in 1932, made a frequently quoted statement that characterized a further key aspect in Swedish social democracy. The folkhemmet, or conception of society and the state as the people's home. The basis of the home is togetherness and common feeling. The good house does not consider anyone either as privileged or unappreciated. It knows no special favorites or stepchildren. There, no one looks down upon anyone else. There, no one tries to gain advantage at another's expense, and the stronger do not suppress and plunder the weaker. In the good home, equality, consideration, cooperation, and helpfulness prevail. Applied to the great people's and citizens' home, this would mean the breaking down of all the social and economic barriers that now divide citizens into the privileged and the unfortunate, into rulers and subjects. In its unbroken period of rule from 1932 until 1976, the SAP introduced a series of major and enduring economic and social reforms that were broadly in harmony with these sentiments. A further characteristic of Swedish social democracy was the fact that it rested as much on trade unionism, and particularly the blue-collar federation, the LOW, Landsorganisationen, as on the party. This, of course, was not unique to Sweden, for there was also an organic relationship between British trade unionism and